Chapter 18. I took care to spread that little fact as far as I could, and prepare the world for the event. I take credit to myself for our plan of selling the pictures. It was mine. I suggested it that last evening, when we were laying out our campaign, and all three of us agreed to give it a good fair trial, before giving it up for some other. It succeeded with all of us. I walked only 2 days. Claude walked too, both of afraid to make Millet celebrated too close to home, but Carl walked only half a day, the bright conscienceless rascal, and after that he traveled like a duke. Every now and then we got in with a country editor, and started an item around through the press. Not an item announcing that a new painter had been discovered, but an item which led on that everybody knew François Millet. Not an item praising him in any way, but merely a word concerning the present condition of the Astor, sometimes hopeful, sometimes despondent, but always tinged with fears for the worst. We always marked these paragraphs, and sent the papers to all the people who had bought pictures of us. Carl was soon in Paris and he worked things with a high hand. He made friends with the correspondents, and got Millet's condition reported to England and all over the continent, and America, and everywhere. At the end of 6 weeks from the start, we three met in Paris, and called a halt, and stopped sending back to Millet for additional pictures. The boom was so high, and everything so ripe, that we saw that it would be a mistake not to strike now, right away, without waiting any longer. So we wrote Millet to go to bed and begin to waste away pretty fast, for we should like him to die in 10 days, if he could get ready. Then we figured up and found that among us, we had sold 85 small pictures and studies, and had 69,000 francs to show for it. Carl had made the last sale, and the most brilliant one of all. He sold the Angelus for 2,200 francs. How we did glorify him! Not foreseeing that a day was coming by and by when France would struggle to own it, and a stranger would capture it for 550,000 cash. We had a wind-up champagne supper that night, and next day Claude and I packed up, and went off to nurse Millet through his last days and keep busybodies out of the house, and send daily bulletins to Carl in Paris for publication in the papers of several continents for the information of a waiting world. The sad end came at last, and Carl was there in time to help in the final mournful rites. You remember that great funeral, and what a stir it made all over the globe, and how the illustrious of two worlds came to attend it and testify their sorrow. We four, still inseparable, carried the coffin, and would allow none to help. And we were right about that, because it hadn't anything in it but a wax figure, and any other coffin bearers would have found fault with the weight. Yes, we same old four, who had lovingly shared privation together in the old hard times now gone forever, carried the cough, apostrophe, which four? Apostrophe, apostrophe, we four, for Millet helped to carry his own coffin. In disguise, you know. Disguised as a relative, distant relative. Apostrophe, astonishing. Apostrophe, apostrophe, but true just the same. Well, you remember how the pictures went up. Money? We didn't know what to do with it. There's a man in Paris today who owns 70 Millet pictures. He paid us 2 million francs for them. And as for the bushels of sketches and studies which Millet shoveled out during the 6 weeks that we were on the road, well, it would astonish you to know the figure we sell them at nowadays, that is, when we consent to let one go. Apostrophe, apostrophe, it is a wonderful history, perfectly wonderful. Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, it amounts to that. Apostrophe, apostrophe, whatever became of Millet? Apostrophe, apostrophe, can you keep a secret? Apostrophe, apostrophe, I can. Apostrophe, apostrophe, do you remember the man I called your attention to in the dining room today? That was François Millet. Apostrophe, great apostrophe, Scott. Yes. For once they didn't starve a genius to death, and then put into other pockets the rewards he should have had himself. This songbird was not allowed to pipe out its heart unheard, and then be paid with the cold pomp of a big funeral. We looked out for that. Apostrophe. My debut as a literary person, in those early days I had already published One Little Thing, The Jumping Frog, in an Eastern paper, but I did not consider that that counted. In my view, a person who published things in a mere newspaper could not properly claim recognition as a literary person. He must rise away above that. He must appear in a magazine. He would then be a literary person. Also, he would be famous right away. These two ambitions were strong upon me. This was in 1866. I prepared my contribution, and then looked around for the best magazine to go up to glory in. I selected the most important one in New York. The contribution was accepted. I signed it Mark Twain, apostrophe for that name at some currency on the Pacific coast, and it was my idea to spread it all over the world now, at this one jump. The article appeared in the December number, and I sat up a month waiting for the January number, for that one would contain the year's list of contributors. My name would be in it, and I should be famous, and could give the banquet I was meditating. I did not give the banquet. I had not written the Mark Twain distinctly. It was a fresh name to Eastern printers, and they put it Mike Swain or McSwain, apostrophe I do not remember which. At any rate, I was not celebrated, and I did not give the banquet. I was a literary person, but that was all a buried one, buried alive. My article was about the burning of the clipper ship Hornet on the line, May 3, 1866. There were 31 men on board at the time, and I was in Honolulu when the 15 lean and ghostly survivors arrived there after a voyage of 43 days, in an open boat, through the blazing tropics, on 10 days' rations of food. A very remarkable trip, but it was conducted by a captain who was a remarkable man, otherwise there would have been no survivors. He was a New Englander of the best sea-going stock of the old capable times, Captain Josiah Mitchell. I was in the islands to write letters for the weekly edition of the Sacramento Union, apostrophe a rich and influential daily journal which hadn't any use for them, but could afford to spend $20 a week for nothing. The proprietors were lovable and well-beloved men. Long ago dead, no doubt, but in me there is at least one person who still holds them in grateful remembrance. For I dearly wanted to see the islands, and they listened to me, and gave me the opportunity, when there was but slender likelihood, that it could profit them in any way. I had been in the islands several months when the survivors arrived. I was laid up in my room at the time, and unable to walk. Here was a great occasion to serve my journal, and I not able to take advantage of it. Necessarily I was in deep trouble. But by good luck His Excellency Anson Burlingame was there at the time, on his way to take up his post in China, where he did such good work for the United States. He came and put me on a stretcher, and had me carried to the hospital, where the shipwrecked men were, and I never needed to ask a question. He attended to all of it himself, and I had nothing to do but make the notes. It was like him to take that trouble. He was a great man and a great American, and it was in his fine nature to come down from his high office and do a friendly turn whenever he could. We got through with this work at 6 in the evening. I took no dinner, for there was no time to spare if I would meet the other correspondents. I spent 4 hours arranging the notes in their proper order, then wrote all night and beyond it, with this result, that I had a very long and detailed account of the Hornet episode ready at 9 in the morning, while the other correspondents of the San Francisco journals had nothing but a brief outline report, for they didn't sit up. The now and then schooner was to sail for San Francisco about 9. When I reached the dock she was free forward, and was just casting off her stern line. My fat envelope was thrown by a strong hand, and fell on board all right, and my victory was a safe thing. All in due time the ship reached San Francisco, but it was my complete report which made the stir, and was telegraphed to the New York papers by Mr. Cash. He was in charge of the Pacific Bureau of the New York Herald at the time. When I returned to California by and by, I went up to Sacramento and presented a bill for general correspondence at $20 a week. It was paid. Then I presented a bill for special service on the Hornet matter of 3 columns of solid nonpareil at $100 a column. The cashier didn't faint, but he came rather near it. He sent for the proprietors, and they came, and never uttered a protest. They only laughed in their jolly fashion, and said it was robbery, but no matter, it was a grand scoop, the bill or my Hornet report, I didn't know which, colon pay it. It's all right. Apostrophe the best man that ever owned a newspaper. The Hornet survivors reached the Sandwich Islands the 15th of June. They were mere skinny skeletons. Their clothes hung limp about them, and fitted them no better than a flag fits the flagstaff in a calm. But they were well nursed in the hospital. The people of Honolulu kept them supplied with all the dainties they could need. They gathered strength fast, and were presently nearly as good as new. Within a fortnight the most of them took ship for San Francisco. That is, if my dates have not gone astray in my memory. I went in the same ship, a sailing vessel. Captain Mitchell of the Hornet was along, also the only passengers the Hornet had carried. These were two young men from Stamford, Connecticut, brothers. Samuel and Henry Ferguson. The Hornet was a clipper of the first class and a fast sailer. The young men's quarters were roomy and comfortable, and were well stocked with books, and also with canned meats and fruits, to help out the ship fare with. And when the ship cleared from New York Harbor in the first week of January, there was promise that she would make quick and pleasant work of the 14,000 or 15,000 miles in front of her. As soon as the cold latitudes were left behind, and the vessel entered summer weather, the voyage became a holiday picnic. The ship flew southward under a cloud of sail which needed no attention, no modifying or change of any kind, for days together. The young men read, strolled the ample deck, rested and drowsed in the shade of the canvas, took their meals with the captain, and when the day was done they played dummy whist with him till bedtime. After the snow and ice and tempests of the Horn, the ship bowled northward into summer weather again, and the trip was a picnic once more. Until the early morning of the 3rd of May. Computed position of the ship 112 degrees 10 minutes longitude, latitude 2 degrees above the equator, no wind, no sea, dead calm, temperature of the atmosphere, tropical, blistering, unimaginable by one who has not been roasted in it. There was a cry of fire. An unfaithful sailor had disobeyed the rules, and gone into the booby hatch with an open light to draw some varnish from a cask. The proper result followed, and the vessel's hours were numbered. There was not much time to spare, but the captain made the most of it. The 3 boats were launched, longboat and 2 quarter boats. That the time was very short, and the hurry and excitement considerable is indicated by the fact that in launching the boats a hole was stove in the side of one of them by some sort of collision, and an oar driven through the side of another. The captain's first care was to have 4 sick sailors brought up, and placed on deck out of harm's way, among them a portee. ... This man had not done a day's work on the voyage, but had lain in his hammock 4 months nursing an abscess. When we were taking notes in the Honolulu hospital, and a sailor told this to Mr. Burlingame, the third mate, who was lying near, raised his head with an effort, and in a weak voice made this correction with solemnity and feeling. Raising abscesses. He had a family of them. He done it to keep from standing his watch. ... Any provisions that lay handy were gathered up by the men and 2 passengers and brought and dumped on the deck where the portee lay. Then they ran for more. The sailor who was telling this to Mr. Burlingame added, "We pulled together 32 days' rations for the 31 men that way. Apostrophe apostrophe, the third mate lifted his head again, and made another correction with bitterness. There were the 22 of them, while he was soldiering there and nobody noticing. A damned hound. Apostrophe, the fire spread with great rapidity. The smoke and flame drove the men back, and they had to stop their incomplete work of fetching provisions, and take to the boats with only 10 days' rations secured. Each boat had a compass, a quadrant, a copy of Bowditch's navigator, apostrophe and a nautical almanac, and the captain's and chief mate's boats had chronometers. There were 31 men all told. The captain took an account of stock, with the following result. 4 hams, nearly 30 pounds of salt pork, half box of raisins, 100 pounds of bread, 12 2-pound cans of oysters, clams, and assorted meats, a keg containing 4 pounds of butter, 12 gallons of water in a 40-gallon scuttle butt, 4 1-gallon demijohns full of water, 3 bottles of brandy the property of passengers, some pipes, matches, and 100 pounds of tobacco. No medicines. Of course the whole party had to go on short rations at once. The captain and the 2 passengers kept diaries. On our voyage to San Francisco we ran into a calm in the middle of the Pacific, and did not move a rod during 14 days. This gave me a chance to copy the diaries. Samuel Ferguson's is the fullest. I will draw upon it now. When the following paragraph was written, the doomed ship was about 120 days out from port, and all hands were putting in the lazy time about as usual, as no one was forecasting disaster. Diary entry, May 2. Latitude 1 degree 28 minutes N, longitude 111 degrees 38 minutes W. Another hot and sluggish day. At one time, however, the clouds promised wind, and there came a slight breeze just enough to keep us going. The only thing to chronicle today is the quantities of fish about. 9 bonitos were caught this forenoon, and some large albacore seen. After dinner the first mate hooked a fellow which he could not hold, so he let the line go to the captain, who was on the bow. He, holding on, brought the fish to with a jerk, and snap went the line, hook and all. We also saw stern, swimming lazily after us, an enormous shark, which must have been 9 or 10 feet long. We tried him with all sorts of lines and a piece of pork, but he declined to take hold. I suppose he had appeased his appetite on the heads, and other remains of the bonitos we had thrown overboard. Next day's entry records the disaster. The 3 boats got away, retired to a short distance, and stopped. The 2 injured ones were leaking badly. Some of the men were kept busy bailing, others patched the holes as well as they could. The captain, the 2 passengers, and 11 men were in the long boat, with a share of the provisions and water, and with no room to spare, for the boat was only 21 feet long, 6 wide, and 3 deep. The chief mate and 8 men were in one of the small boats, the second mate and 7 men in the other. The passengers had saved no clothing but what they had on, excepting their overcoats. The ship, clothed in flame and sending up a vast column of black smoke into the sky, made a grand picture in the solitudes of the sea, and hour after hour the outcasts sat and watched it. Meantime the captain ciphered on the immensity of the distance that stretched between him and the nearest available land, and then scaled the rations down to meet the emergency. Half a biscuit for dinner, 1 biscuit and some canned meat for dinner, half a biscuit for tea, a few swallows of water for each meal. And so hunger began to gnaw, while the ship was still burning. Diary entry, May 4. The ship burned all night very brightly, and hopes are that some ship has seen the light, and is bearing down upon us. None seen, however, this forenoon, so we have determined to go. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.